This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. President Donald Trump is in Great Britain this week in advance of commemorations for the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion in World War II. The president is no stranger to political controversy in this country, but he visits the UK at a time of significant political turmoil.
But these are not entirely unprecedented times in which we live. Art Sear is our foreign policy contributor and joins us to share some historical perspective on President Trump's visit and also to examine the state of politics in the UK as Prime Minister Theresa May's time in office comes to a rapid conclusion. Nice to see you, Art.
Well, thank you, Mitch. A pleasure to be here.
As we're having this conversation, the President of the United States, President Trump, is making a state visit to the UK at a really tumultuous time for politics in that country. But we were talking before we turned on the microphone just a little bit about the reception that the president gets in various places. And I want to turn the clock back about 50 years here to Lyndon Johnson, who was he was president at a sort of similarly tumultuous time. And you were kind of sharing the days when the president was really challenged to speak anywhere in this country.
Yes, indeed. Well, President Johnson was a very different sort of president and personality, but thanks to the Vietnam War and some other things, but especially Vietnam, which literally tore our country apart in the 60s and continued to resonate long thereafter. I was making the point that during President Johnson's last year in office, the only place he could or would speak, the Secret Service was quite adamant, publicly was on military bases around the United States. And the dynamic is very different today in all kinds of ways. President Trump, for all the media attention and controversy, and his extreme rhetoric and extreme reactions to him were not certainly not in that period. Lyndon Johnson, I believe strongly, will also go down as a very consequential president concerning especially the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts, Medicare, Head Start, and other programs directed at the poorer sectors in society.
But by 1968, those things were sort of in the background while Vietnam.
Everything was overcome by Vietnam. And that president, colorful as he always was earlier toward the end, said quite regularly as the war began to consume everything else, the Great Society, this tremendous social and economic reform program that he got through Congress, is the dimension of my work, to put it that way, that I love, but this war is dragging me down, and the war has me around the neck and won't let go. It really was a tragic presidency in many ways, but he was fortunate, tragically, in the sense that between the assassination of President Kennedy in Dallas on November 22, 1963, and the big escalation of the war in 65, going into 66, during that time, the president was able to move a tremendous amount of legislation through Congress, a lot of it very durable. He also dominated the Senate in the 1950s to a remarkable degree. His style and temperament and personality could be so off-putting that his tremendous gifts as a politician in that era are too easily overlooked. Robert Caro, C-A-R-O, whose serious work has been discussed on public radio quite appropriately, his multi-volume biography of President Johnson is really worth time and attention.
Well, and move forward 5 or 6 years, and similarly towards the end of the Nixon presidency, there were fewer and fewer places in this country where he was comfortable speaking as well, in really a circumstance of his own devising.
Yeah, also a tragic end to a presidency. Both leaders were crucially involved in bringing themselves down. But I do think President Johnson was more a victim of circumstances. I think Kennedy probably would have maneuvered us out of Vietnam. He was simply too smart to get trapped. But President Johnson was trapped overall by the fact that he was supposed to be fulfilling the legacy of his martyred predecessor. And it was almost impossible, I think, for him, despite his legislative strengths, to resist the tremendous pressure from the military, but also what we call the military-industrial complex, and public opinion generally to escalate in Vietnam. With Nixon, it's more Shakespearean. He's more directly involved in destroying himself politically, in my view. As I tell our students, you can't have your own facts, you can't have your own opinions. And on these complex subjects, it's really important for each of us to develop our own point of view. I'm just giving you mine.
Well, okay, so let's return to the present then and President Trump's visit to the UK. What does he see in what is the opportunity for him? Why is it important for him to be there at this time? Obviously, we're coming up on the anniversary of D-Day.
Yes, and that really cemented the Anglo-American alliance. It's always tough to run any alliance. Winston Churchill famously liked to say the only thing worse than trying to collaborate with allies is not having any allies at all. The British, from before the beginning of World War II in Europe, were working assiduously to create a strong relationship with the U.S. King George VI and the Queen visited Washington, I believe, in 1939. Just before Germany invaded Poland. It was orchestrated by the British government through their representatives in Canada, a very shrewd decision early on to get together with our former rivals and enemies, the Americans. And after Churchill became first Sea Lord, Secretary of the Navy, and then Prime Minister after the fall of France, it became a priority. And they would market him like a product in the U.S. When you read especially the diaries of that period, but lots of good histories, these very sophisticated men and women in the British government who were not provincial people, they would come back from the States saying, it's unbelievable what these Americans have. It's truly unbelievable. Working people, we're still in the Depression, working people have automobiles. They have motor cars. They can afford their own radios. They have, you know, single dwellings. It's just extraordinary what they have. Their resources are endless. And if we're going to eventually win in this conflict with the Third Reich, we've got to get them on our side. Farsightedness, that's something we Americans don't do very well. And the British continue to survive through all kinds of difficulties, I think partly because they do that characteristically. That's the nature of really good diplomacy.
Well, and so the British government is at a pivotal point right now with Theresa May stepping down, having fallen victim to an ongoing saga over Brexit. What does the UK get out of a presidential visit at this point in time, if anything?
Well, our current president is kind of the American stereotype that they love to hate. He seems to me to personify an image of the ugly American that is quite widespread around the world. And at some level, it's almost enjoyable to read about or listen to parliamentary debates where earlier on after his election, there were intense statements about banning him from the United Kingdom, and they go on and on and on. So in that sense, he's useful, not just to people on the left.
In the sense that we might have it bad here, but here's somebody we think of as worse?
Yeah, although ironically, if the British do leave the European Union, the shorthand term for that is Brexit.
Yeah.
I think it'll be an opportunity which both sides will probably take advantage of to reinforce already important ties with the Americans, especially, again, in the field of defense, national security, bilateral military cooperation, and especially intelligence, where I believe historically they do better than we do. But in any case, that was the true beginning of the special relationship. And that's important news to follow that won't be in the headlines generally.
There are a number of polls that show increasing support in the UK for Brexit without any plan in place. And I guess, what do you read into the sentiment that says, we're just going to leave the European Union, consequences be damned?
I think that would be very disruptive, especially for the usual people who get hurt by big economic dislocations, again, working people, not only in Britain but also on the continent. I think they will work it out. I hope that they will have another referendum. The Conservatives under the last Prime Minister, David Cameron, outsmarted themselves by having a referendum, which they didn't have to have in 2016, which led to a very narrow majority in favor of leaving. I don't think the average Brit really wants to leave without any kind of agreement at all, because common sense does ultimately define that culture more than some others. I think they'll probably have a referendum.
Who do you see filling the power vacuum left by Theresa May?
Well, there is no power vacuum. She has been a remarkably ineffective and frustrated prime minister. She was in favor formally of remaining in the EU before the referendum, and then she called a snap election, which she didn't have to call. They thought they would reinforce their narrow majority. They had quite ruthlessly gotten rid of their coalition partners, the Liberal Democrats. Instead, they lost and are now dependent on an extremely ideological, right-wing, rigid small party from Northern Ireland. It's been a series of missteps, which is not just 2020 hindsight. Why did they have to do this? I think they will emphasize stability above all. I think the Conservatives could still continue in power, but I believe a coalition is much more likely, which makes it too bad Cameron was so unnecessarily brutal toward the Liberal Democrats, although it's a rough system. He was being typically British in the way he treated them.
So I guess let me ask you, and this is maybe unfair as a last question, but this is the last time the two of us will chat on this show together. And, you know, we talk about the State of the Union. Let's talk about the state of the world in the middle of 2019. You know, we talk about the tenuous place that British politics are in. As the two of us wrap up this conversation, it's hard to find a place in the world where things aren't on the precipice of something different.
Rapid change is going on. You're right. And a lot of that rapid change is all to the good. Something like 300 million people, that's million, not thousand, Chinese have gone out of poverty. I mean, real abject day-to-day survival poverty, which is totally alien to American life today, even our poor people, into something that we would consider a reasonable lifestyle in the last quarter of a century, since the great leader Deng Xiaoping declared people socialism. And what's happening in China, to a greater or lesser degree, is happening around the world. Africa is now a special presence, is now highlighted on the remarkably friendly World Bank website, I must say. Africa as a magnet for foreign investment of all kinds, and not just by China, by private capital, especially from all over the world, especially this country. And it's not the usual infrastructure, not the usual mining and basic infrastructure projects. All kinds of construction and investment is going on. Women are rising dramatically in political participation, literally all around the world, including in Africa and South Asia and Islamic countries. And that's a guarantor of more law-abiding government, of decline in population growth, all the good things in life. So I would say there's a lot that's very positive, and the really hateful and devastating ideologies of the 20th century, Nazism, fascism, communism, they faded. There's only a couple outposts left in the world. So to me, it's very positive. I realize that's not a popular point of view, and that's not the way a lot of American young people see the world today, because I have the privilege of dealing with them regularly.
Is the friction now not so much between haves and haves and not have-nots, but haves and have-mores?
I think, yes, that's quite right. I do think it's unhealthy that in this country, especially, income differentials since about 1970 have grown dramatically from the beginning of the New Deal. Through the 1960s, we had a reversal of that trend. It's become much more like the 1920s. That's politically destructive as well as, from my point of view, immoral. It's a recipe for political conflict. But working people in the States today are far better off than working people in the 1920s. It's easy to do. Take a look at what Ford Motor Company workers were living on and how they were living before the autocratic and brilliant, very difficult Henry Ford took charge of worker lifestyles and started building cars that they could afford. He took a lot of grief from other automakers, but he would tell them regularly, fellas, we want our workers not only to be healthy enough to be productive, but we want them to be able to buy our damn cars. If workers aren't making them, eventually we'll go down. And we're not in that revolutionary situation today. Again, that's my opinion. We'll see.
Art Sear, it has been a pleasure talking with you over the past 13 years, and to be continued.
Well, thank you for all you've done. Yes, indeed. I look forward to talking to you from your new home, I hope.
Lake Effect contributor Art Sear is a professor of political economy and world business, and he directs the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. You can listen to our past conversations with him at wuwm.com.